The book of Deuteronomy is a sermonic recap given by Moses just prior to his death. The word Deuteronomy comes from two Greek words which were used in the Septuagint, namely deuteros, meaning second, and nomos, meaning law. So the word really means second law or second giving of the law. After the children of Israel arrived in the Transjordan, Moses sat down and in the year 1406 recounted all of the past events which had happened since the Exodus. In Deuteronomy 1:1, we read, "These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel on this side, Jordan, in the wilderness, in the plain against the Red Sea." We have further clarification in verse 5, "On this side Jordan, in the land of Moab, began Moses to declare the law, saying." Then finally in Deuteronomy 34:1, "Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo." Deuteronomy 34:5 says, "Moses died in the land of Moab, and he was 120 years old, and the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. As the entire host of Israelites remains on the east side or in the Transjordan area, preparations are being made for a military move across the Jordan to occupy the land in the Cisjordan or the land of Canaan west of the Jordan River. This entire area is the area previously promised to Abraham and his descendants almost 700 years before. And now this cup of iniquity, which was not full during Abraham's time, is now full. The period of grace has come to an end, and the children of Israel are ready to occupy the land. This occupation serves a dual purpose. Not only is it a land for the children of Israel to inhabit, but it is also to serve as God's holy war against the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. Reading Deuteronomy 9, verse 4, "Speak not thou in thine heart after that the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying, For my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. But for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord doth drive them out from before thee." So here we have the dual purpose. One, to occupy the land for the promise made to Abraham, and two, to drive out the wicked inhabitants of the land. So this is God's holy war, and he has chosen as his instrument in his holy war the nation of Israel. Until the discovery of the Ugarit tablets in the early part of this century, we had no idea about the extent to which the religious system in the land of Canaan had corrupted itself even since the time of Abraham. But thanks to the Ugarit tablets, we can see the demonic, licentious worship system which had evolved. And it is this worship system that the Israelites are warned over and over again throughout the book of Numbers and throughout the book of Deuteronomy to guard themselves against. And it is because of the prevalence of this worship system in the land that the Israelites are to kill every single inhabitant, because if even one remains alive, this one will corrupt the nation of Israel, and the program that they are to use in the land to promote the true religion of Jehovah will be corrupted. So God instructs them to exterminate the inhabitants. We had a brief example of the worship of Baal in the Baal-Peor encounter in the book of Numbers, and the tribe of Simeon primarily being a leader in this involvement with the women of Moab. Briefly, the worship of Baal is a combination of sexual activity and human sacrifice. The inhabitants of this area of the world are agrarian by occupation, and cattle raisers by occupation. And as a result, their income and livelihood is tied to the land, whether Canaanite or Israelite. So the important thing to these inhabitants is fertility. They want the land to be fertile. They want the cattle, the sheep, to be fertile. And they want their wives to be fertile. So to the Canaanite, fertility is the key issue. And his worship system revolves around fertility. And as we examine these artifacts from that time period, we can see that the human figures, which are designed for idolatrous worship, are designed in such a way as to promote fertility. Baal, therefore, means Lord. Baalim means lords. Baal is the god of storm, the god of fertility. And one of the primary Baals in the land was Hadad, the storm god. And he is seen riding on a bull, which is one of the Canaanite symbols for fertility. And to pacify the Baals in many parts of Canaan, the Canaanites would offer their children as sacrifices. The children were to be offered without any display of emotion. And should a display of emotion be made, then the sacrifice would be worthless. In the Baal temples, there were male cult prostitutes and female cult prostitutes. These were priests and priestesses of Baal. And if a man wanted to worship Baal, he would go up and join himself to a priestess. And if a woman wanted to worship, she would go up and join herself to a priest. We will find in the Old Testament later on that these male prostitutes were called dogs. And through sexual relations with the priest or priestess, the worshiper was saying, just as fertility is taking place during this act, may Baal make my crops fertile, may Baal make my cattle fertile, and may Baal make my spouse fertile. So all of the outward physical manifestations of fertility were worshipped. Rain, storm, fire, and famine and drought and good crops and bad crops were seen as the result of Baal's blessing or judgment on the earth. And it is for this reason that throughout the balance of the Old Testament, we will notice that when God encounters this false worship system through his prophets, that these various physical phenomena are used to demonstrate to the inhabitants of the land that God, Jehovah, is the one who provides fertility, and that it is God who is responsible for rain and good crops and cattle reproduction. So when we read about fire falling from heaven, oil that does not cease, the dead being brought back to life, God causing it not to rain, God causing crops not to grow, God causing drought, we will see that these are not cheap parlor tricks, but are polemics against Baalism, so that the inhabitants of the land will see that God is the one that is responsible for these things and not Baal. Later on, when the Israelites themselves become Baalists, the prophets will demonstrate to these people that God is responsible for all of these physical elements, which relate to fertility of the land, the cattle, and the people as well. So it is because of this corrupt system that God is offended to the point to where he wants to totally exterminate the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. And in his holy war, the Israelites will function as the military spearhead. And because of this, I believe that we can look with assurance on the fact that had the Israelites behaved in such a way that they were totally obedient to God's command and ordinances, then they could have fought all of the battles in the land of Canaan. They could completely have occupied the land and never have lost a man. Back in the book of Numbers, chapter 31, verse 49, following a battle in which the Israelites were completely obedient, the scripture says that the men said to Moses, "We have taken a census of the men of war who are in our charge, and not a man is missing." This is God's war, and he is not going to suffer the loss of any of his warriors if the war is being fought according to his ordinances and his commandments. And we will find later on in the book of Joshua that this is exactly the case. The second aspect of the occupation of the land regarding the territory promised to Abram simply serves as fulfillment of the earlier prophecy, keeping in mind that when these 2 million people left the land of Egypt, they were hardly much more than a mob, however they were a people, but they were not yet a nation. But it takes three things to be a nation, and one of the three things is that there must be a people. But secondly, there must be a constitution, and it was on Mount Sinai when God gave the Ten Commandments and the ordinances by which these people must live that the constitution was given. So for the 40 years in the wilderness, and now on the east side of the Jordan, we have a people and we have a constitution. The only thing remaining is the land. So once they cross over the Jordan and begin to occupy this territory, they will be a nation. Just as when the Jews occupied the land in 1948 A.D., in the same way, once the occupation is made in 1406 B.C. under Joshua, they will have the land that will make them a nation. Finally, in regard to the religion of the land, Deuteronomy 11, verses 16 and 17, give the Israelites advance warning of what will happen. He says, "Don't let your hearts be deceived," in verse 16, "and serve these other gods and worship them." In other words, and think that these other gods will be the ones that will give your land fertility. Or else, verse 17, "The anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens. And because of his anger, there will be no rain, and the ground will not yield its fruit." So God in chapter 11 reaffirms the fact that it is God who is responsible for fertility and not Baal. In preparation for the occupation of the land, and with Moses giving the sermonic recap and historical recap in the book of Deuteronomy, he also gives instructions under God for the occupation of the land, and the instruction is given well within the hearing of Joshua, and as the second in command, Joshua is fully versed on these things. And chapter 20 in the book of Deuteronomy contains what I call the military manual for the occupation of the land. As Moses prepares these people for what will follow, he says in verse 8, "And the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return into his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. So if any of you are afraid, if any of you are chicken, so to speak, go back now. Don't go out to battle with us, because if you get out there and decide that it's too much for you and you want to turn and run, chances are that when others see you running, they'll turn aside as well. So make up your mind now. If you're going to go out to fight, be a man. And if you're afraid to go, then stay back." The military manual begins with verse 10, and verses 10 through 14 contain the criteria for approaching a city described in verse 15. So I believe we should read verse 15 first. "Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations." These nations refers to the nations which God has instructed the Israelites to completely exterminate. But around the peripheral areas of the land of Canaan, there are cities afar off. And the cities afar off are not specifically designated for extinction. So beginning in verse 10, God gives instructions for dealing with these cities which are far off. Beginning in verse 10, "When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath given it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword, but of the women and of the little ones and the cattle, and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, thou shalt take unto thyself, and thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies which the Lord thy God hath given thee." Simply put, phase one says this: When you go to a city afar off that is not designated for extinction, offer peace to it. If they come out and say, we surrender, take them and let them serve you. If they say, no, we will fight you, then the Lord will give you the city. And when you go in there, you kill all the men, but you can take the women and the children and all the cattle and keep them for yourselves. However, verse 16, but of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely, the Hittites, and the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. Why, Lord, this seems rather extreme. The answer is in verse 18, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations, which they have done unto their gods, so should ye sin against the Lord your God. God knows that once the people begin to practice these things, that their sons and daughters, their husbands and wives will get involved in the formal worship system of the land, and that even the Israelite women and men will become prostitutes in the houses of Baal. Chapter 23, verses 17 and 18 give this warning, there shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel. Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog, that's the male cult prostitute, into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow, for even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. After the Exodus, some 40 years prior to Deuteronomy 25, Moses encountered Amalek, and Joshua was the general in that battle. And God warned them that there would be battle with Amalek from generation to generation. And now in chapter 25, verses 17 through 19, Moses reminds the people once again of what happened so that they do not forget their involvement with Amalek and the promise of God to eventually judge Amalek for what he did. In verse 17, remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it. So the promised judgment against Amalek is reaffirmed 40 years after his attack, but the final judgment on Amalek will not come for over 350 years. One of the things which always occurs in human nature is that once several generations have passed, the younger generation always forgets what the previous generation learned. We know that it was Adam's job to pass on the truth of God to his descendants, and he failed. It was Noah's job to pass on the truth of God to his descendants, and he failed. It was the job of Abraham to pass on the knowledge of God to his descendants, and he failed. And now Moses is instructed very plainly to pass these things on to the sons and the sons' sons. And through this word-of-mouth method, the truth of God was to be transmitted from generation to generation. But can you imagine what the response was to those individuals who were five and six generations removed from Adam, when Adam tried to explain to them that he was created by God and used to walk in the cool of the day with God himself? I'm sure that that wicked generation laughed and thought he was insane. When Noah tried to explain to his descendants, several generations removed, that he had seen the flood, and when his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, attempted to explain to their grandchildren and great-grandchildren that at one time the entire earth had been covered by water, and that they had lived in the pre-flood era, I'm sure that these individuals thought they were insane as well.
And we know that by the time several generations pass, that the truth that is attempted to be passed on by the previous generations is mocked and scoffed and assumed to be worthless, mythical information. And because of this, God, in anticipation of this fact, in chapter 31, tells Moses that he knows what's going to happen because God is omniscient. And he says in verse 16 that when they get into the land, they will play the harlot with strange gods, and they will forsake me, God says. And then God says in verse 17, I will forsake them and hide my face from them. And he says, just so they remember generations and centuries from now that I told them this would happen, I want you to compose a song. And although many things may pass away, the Israelites were ones who would pass along a song or an epic poem from generation to generation. The song would be learned, it would be sung, and the next generation would sing it, and the next generation would sing it, and this song will be around for many centuries. And this song is designed so that when later generations sing it, they can remember back to a time when God gave this song, and the title of this song should be Against Forgetfulness. And the purpose of this song, this epic poem, is to remind the people that God anticipated their failure and that there was still hope if they would repent and turn back to Him. The epic poem requires 43 verses in chapter 32, and it is in this marvelous piece of poetry that God reminds them that He made them suck honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, but they decided to serve idols and other demons that claimed to be gods. And God warns them in the song that He will heap misfortune upon them and assures them in the end of vengeance and that blood will be avenged, which has been shed by the enemies of His servants. The remainder of chapter 32 contains the instruction by God to Moses regarding his death and the reason for his early death prior to entering the land, because faith had been broken in the matter of the rock. In chapter 33, Moses blesses the children of Israel prior to his death, which is recorded in chapter 34. And in verse 7, we see that Moses was 120 years old when he died. With the death of Moses in 1406, we have completed the first five books of the Old Testament, the five books of which Moses was the author. In these five books, we have covered the history of the world from creation down through the flood, the Tower of Babel, the selection of Abram, the birth of Isaac, the birth of Jacob, the birth of the sons of Jacob, the 430 years of captivity in Egypt, the birth of Moses, the plagues on Egypt, the various murmurings and rebellions of the people of Israel prior to the entrance into the land in 1445. As a result of their murmurings and disobedience, God forced them to spend the remaining 39 years wandering in the wilderness, during which time no numbered man over age 20 would survive. And now, with the death of Moses, this multitude of people sits on the east side of the Jordan River. The leader that they have known for these many years is dead. The baton of leadership has passed to Joshua. And the inhabitants of the land of Canaan are anticipating military activity as they look eastward across the Jordan and see these people that they know have been successful in previous battles against the Midianites, against the inhabitants of Heshbon and Edrei, and I believe that their hearts are beginning to melt. And the inhabitants of the eastern side of the Jordan, the Israelites, are beginning to become anxious to enter the land for this military conquest under the leadership of Joshua. The book of Joshua begins with the charge to Joshua following the death of Moses. And God very matter-of-factly says in verse 2 that Moses, my servant, is dead. And he gives Joshua the assurance in verse 5 that no man will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I have been with Moses, I will be with you. And the criteria for success are contained in verse 7 of chapter 1.
He is told to be strong and courageous. He is told to do all in the law that Moses commanded him. He is told to meditate in the book of the law day and night. And because of that, he is assured by God that his way will be prosperous in verse 8, and he will have good success. Since they are sitting on the east side of the Jordan River, preparing to invade the Cisjordan, he now speaks to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and reminds them of the previous agreement that they made regarding using their fighting forces to assist the remaining 9.5 tribes in conquering the land. And he says in verse 12, "And to the Reubenites and to the Gadites and to half the tribe of Manasseh spake Joshua, saying, Remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, The Lord your God hath given you rest and hath given you this land," in other words, on the east side of the Jordan. "Your wives, your little ones, and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side Jordan. But ye shall pass before your brethren armed, all the mighty men of valor, and help them, until the Lord have given your brethren rest, as he hath given you, and they also have possessed the land which the Lord your God giveth them. Then ye shall return unto the land of your possession and enjoy it, which Moses the Lord's servant gave you on this side Jordan, toward the sun rising, toward the east. And they answered Joshua, saying, All that thou commandest us we will do, and whithersoever thou sendest us we will go." And the final remark they made in verse 17 would make me very nervous if I were Joshua, because they said, "According as we have hearkened unto Moses in all things, so we will hearken unto thee." This is disturbing because in retrospect we know that none of the tribes actually hearkened unto Moses. They continually grumbled and mumbled. And now once they are in the land of Canaan, we will discover that the battles go quite well. The people do, for the most part, hearken unto Joshua. But unfortunately, a generation will come along that did not know Moses, and they will fall into continued apostasy. This concludes number 4, side 2. The first 4 cassettes have covered the period from Genesis to Deuteronomy.
This is the end of number 4.